Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. Thank you for joining us today, and I hope you are staying well and safe wherever you are. In each new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, we are joined by an author who has published a book that is relevant to the field of Islamic studies as it is broadly defined, and we have a conversation with the author. Here, There, and Elsewhere, The Making of Immigrant Identities in a Globalized World, which is published by Stanford University Press in 2020, is a book by Professor Tahseen Shams, who's an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Toronto in Canada. The book reconceptualizes the homeland-hostland dyad using experiences of diasporic South Asian Muslim communities in America, namely Bangladeshis, Pakistanis, and Indians. Shams introduces an innovative conceptual notion of elsewhere, which informs her new multi-centered approach to the study of globalized immigrant identities, using ethnographic study, social media analysis, and also autoethnographic reflections. She provocatively highlights how, for her varied participants, their identities as South Asian Muslim Americans were not only informed by their perception of sending and receiving countries or even their relationship to these places, but was also defined by societies beyond these nation states, especially those that informed their ummatic connection or informed their sense of being part of the global Muslim world, such as countries in the Middle East. In such instances, affinities to elsewhere informed South Asian Muslims' political and social mobilizations, and this was evident in her research during the American presidential elections of 2016, and in other instances of conversations around Palestinian plight and ideas of divestment. Still, other elsewhere events, such as ISIS attacks in European countries, such as in Paris or in Germany, also further altered their experiences as Muslims in America, despite not having any affinity or connection to Europe. The introduction of a conceptual paradigm of elsewhere in this study productively unsettles homeland-hostland dynamics as simple and a binary one, and further challenges us to rethink how homeland politics, global Muslim events, and hostland reception dynamics complicate diasporic identity formation in a globalized and transnational context. This book will be of interest to those who work on international migration, diaspora study, South Asian Islam, and Islam in America, and will also be great teaching resource and courses that deal with any of these issues. In our conversations today, Professor Shams and I spoke about some of the methodological approaches that she took to completing this book, some of the challenges she had in doing her ethnographic study, and we also talked through some of the varied examples of elsewhere that she conceptualizes in her book. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Professor Tahseen Shams about her new book, Here, There, and Elsewhere, The Making of Immigrant Identities in a Globalized World. Hi, Tahseen. Thank you so much for joining us today to have a conversation about your new book, Here, There, and Elsewhere, The Making of Immigrant Identities in a Globalized World. How are you doing?
Hi, Shobhana. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to engage with you about the book. I'm doing great. I'm excited. I'm looking forward to your questions. How about you?
I'm okay, I think. Yeah, I'm just going into week two of online teaching. So I think I'm figuring out the rhythm, as I'm sure you are as well, as the University of Toronto. We have a tradition in New Books in Islamic Studies where we like to start our conversation with asking our authors to share something about their intellectual journey and what really brought them to writing this particular book.
Wow, that's a great way to start, because I do think that this book is rooted in my personal story as much as it is rooted in my curiosity as a migration scholar. To give some background about who I am to begin with, I am a first generation Bangladeshi immigrant. I arrived in the United States with my family, my parents and younger brother when I was a teenager, but my first introduction to the United States was in Mississippi, specifically Hattiesburg, a small, predominantly white and conservative college town. My parents still live there, and I try as much as I can during semester breaks to go and visit my parents. So I was doing that while I was a grad student at UCLA. It was a very rough, semester. I think my first or second year of grad school. And I was at my parents in Hattiesburg when the 2015 Charlie Hebdo attacks took place in Paris. To give some background about what it's like living in Hattiesburg in the first place, I did my undergrad there, and I was almost always the only non-white, non-Black person in any classroom I entered. It was isolating, but at the same time, I think it was great for a budding sociologist, because I felt like I had a different point of view from the sidelines than those who were in the field playing the game, so to speak. So when that shocking event of the Charlie Hebdo attack in 2015 took place, I put on my sociologist hat. And as I saw my parents being glued to the TV, watching the live coverage, I saw how fearful they were. They were horrified by the event, but they also feared a backlash similar to 9/11 in their small college town. And they called the handful of other Bangladeshi Muslims that they knew in the area and learned that their friends too were fearing a backlash. One of their friends is a hijabi woman who was studying to become a doctor, but she was frightened to go to the local library the next day to study because she didn't know how people would perceive her headscarf in that context. And the most interesting thing in this personal observation is that later that year, when ISIS attacked the Bataclan, I was back in Los Angeles studying South Asian Muslim communities. But despite the significantly more cosmopolitan milieu in Los Angeles, I saw that the South Asian Muslims there as well feared an Islamophobic backlash. And there too, the common frame of reference among everyone was 9/11, as if the Bataclan and the Charlie Hebdo attacks did not happen far away in France, but in the United States. That observation really opened up this entire idea of the book, because I couldn't find anything in the international migration literature that helped me make sense of these observations. Yes, immigrants have various global connections that transcend homeland hopes and borders, but how do these places beyond the homeland and hostland also shape immigrants' identities? I could not find an answer to this question in the assimilation literature, for instance, because it looked largely at how hostland contexts shaped immigrants' homeland identities over time. Transnationalism largely looked at what happened in the homeland and hostland. So the focus was expanded beyond the hostland, but was still tied within the dyadic homeland-hostland paradigm. And diaspora looked at how members of a dispersed population were linked to a common homeland, but to each other, but largely overlooked the hostland context. So my reading of the international migration literature was that it was largely focused on only the sending and receiving countries, not looking at how places beyond also mattered to immigrants' worldviews, day-to-day interactions. So that was what set me off in my path to writing this book, looking at how places beyond the homeland and hostland, but also related to the sending and receiving countries, also shaped immigrants' identities.
And I think that nicely really sets us up for the conversation that we're going to have. The two pillars, both your personal narrative and how that is woven in so beautifully with kind of the ethnographic work that you've done in the book, and also the conceptual intervention that you're making in the book. So I wonder if we could start first with as you kind of alluded to, the multi-centered approach that you're providing for the readers, and how you're shifting away from just talking about the hostland, homeland dyad, and including this idea of an elsewhere. So can you walk us through what this idea of the elsewhere is, and you know, what are the particulars of it? And I'm sure subsequent conversations will help us unpack it a little bit more with the ethnographic detail you provide in the book.
Of course. I conceptualize elsewhere as a place that is beyond the immigrant's homeland and hostland. So it is not a place where the immigrants have originated, and it's not a place where immigrants now live. In every sense of the word, it is a place that immigrants have only vague ideas about, have never traveled to, have no really meaningful connection based on a sense of diasporic affinity. It could be just anywhere in the world. But that faraway foreign place becomes meaningful to the immigrants based on the interactions at the global level between that faraway place and the immigrant's homeland and hostland. So it's a place that is beyond the immigrant sending and receiving countries, but nonetheless have meaning in both how immigrants locate themselves in a global and hostland sociopolitical hierarchy, and how others around the immigrants perceive immigrants using that lens. So an example that I give in my book is the example of Nigeria. 50% of the population in Nigeria is Muslim. My participants, who are South Asian Muslim Americans from Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan, really had very vague ideas, if at all, about Nigeria. They didn't know what it looked like on the world map. They didn't know the demographic details. All they knew was that it is somewhere in Africa. But Nigeria became relevant to their lives because of Boko Haram, the Islamist group that exploded in the political and popular discourse when it kidnapped 300 Muslim schoolgirls. And even though Boko Haram was active since 2002 to 2004, it only became known in the United States because of Michelle Obama not even launching, but publicizing this campaign to bring back our girls. And it is at that point that for my participants, this faraway foreign place, Nigeria, became very relevant to both how they felt as Muslims in the global space, as well as how others in the United States viewed Muslims. So one of my participants, such as Zinat, who I talk about in the book, she's a hijabi Bangladeshi woman. According to her, Boko Haram gives Islam and Muslims a bad name, and it shapes how Muslims as a whole are perceived in America. Zinat, through my conversations I found, did not know where Nigeria is exactly located, its shape on the world map, its demographic profile, but she has learned from American news channels and social media that Boko Haram is located inside Nigeria, and she understood that what it was doing there can affect her here in America. So I use this example to show how an irrelevant case becomes relevant if events in that faraway foreign place draws the hostland's political and media attention in a way that makes the immigrant's already stigmatized identity, in this case Muslim, even more suspect and vulnerable. So I argue that a place is an elsewhere if the answer is yes to the following question. Do contexts in a place located beyond the homeland and hostland shape how immigrants view themselves, their sense of self, and do those contexts shape how others in the hostland view these immigrants?
And so the rest of the book, you do a deep dive really of like one particular diaspora community in the American context, the South Asian community or Desi community, mainly Indians, Pakistani, and Bangladeshi. And you kind of guide us through unpacking the complexity and the nuances of elsewhere, because you show us that elsewhere itself is not monolithic, but there's actually, you know, kind of tiers of it, and they have moments of shock and moments of kind of different saliences. So before we get to these examples, I wonder if you could share some, you know, your methodological process. You did ethnographic work in LA. How was this like? How is it doing ethnographic work within the South Asian community or in the Bangladeshi community, especially on campuses, as being an insider of the community yourself? Were there any challenges with that process? Were there any kind of successes or fun moments in the field?
Well, that is a great question, because I have had a lot of fun, but also a lot of tension, let's say.
Yeah.
So I am Bangladeshi, but I wasn't, I'm not originally from Los Angeles. So in many ways, while I was perceived as an insider based on, you know, my accent, my last name, the way I look, that, okay, this is a brown person from South Asia. And once they say that I am Bangladeshi, people know that I'm Bangladeshi. But at the same time, I wasn't an insider of the community. So when I started volunteering at a Bangla language school, when I started making connections with South Asian undergraduate students, various cultural associations, I got the sense that people already knew each other. To just give one example, when I first contacted the Muslim Students Association, I learned that the South Asian Muslims there already knew each other from either their local mosques or from other cultural associations, or their parents knew each other. So they already had an idea about the kind of community that they would expect coming into the college campus. So in many ways, I was also an outsider, because they didn't know my parents. They didn't know who I was. So that kind of insider but outsider dynamic really helped me methodologically. I did ethnographic observations, in-depth interviews, and analysis of social media activities of South Asian Muslim Americans. But the fun thing is, I didn't start off with doing all three kinds of analysis. I first just started spending time with my community members and having conversations with them, just establishing trust, and then asking them if they knew anybody who would be interested to help me with my research. So I did my ethnographic field work for 3 years, but after a year and a half, after I felt that I did know a number of people in the community, I was hanging out with a group of girls who went to the same college. They were all Bangladeshi, but very much embedded in a pan-ethnic South Asian community. They had a number of very close Indian and Pakistani friends as well. So through them, I also made connections with other South Asian ethnic communities. But I spent this whole day with these girls. I felt like, yes, I understand where they're coming from, what really matters for their lives. And then the next day, I spend time with them again, and they're talking about things that I have no idea about. So-and-so said this, did you hear that? And I was like, I spent the whole day with these girls. What happened? How do I not know these things? And I realized they were talking to each other on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. Clearly, I was missing out an entire picture that was very relevant to this 1.5 second generation immigrant cohort. So that's when I realized that, I have to systematically collect data on what they are saying, what they're commenting on, what they're posting, what issues they're engaging with. And that's when I started incorporating, folding in the social media analysis. So going back to the insider-outsider, so clearly that's an example of me being an outsider in that community. I really didn't know that, that's a major way in which these people are communicating. But I also felt that when I first asked some of the interviewees questions, they seemed very aloof or, disinterested about really talking about things that I know from the literature matter to Muslim Americans. They would say, like, I don't know, or, I haven't really thought about it. Those things don't really matter to me. And I was a little confused. But then as I started spending time with them, I saw that their Muslim identities did matter in their day-to-day lives. If I asked them during an interview, for instance, can you walk me through your daily life? They would just tell me, I go to classes, I hang out with my friends in the dorm rooms, or, I have a really great roommate that I spend time with. I try to eat at home. Things that you would hear from anybody going to college. But once I started spending time with them, I saw that some of them really took care about their clothing so that they don't have to change their clothes if they wanted to go for prayers in between classes. They wanted to eat halal food, so they asked their parents to, help them with, bring them food in the Tupperwares, so that they don't have to spend extra money seeking out halal food. Or they would spend a lot of time with their roommates and their friends, but the way that they met their roommates, the way that they made friendships, was based on connections that they had made outside of campus, from mosques or through their parents who connected them to other South Asian Muslim families. So that insider-outsider dynamic helped me to really see how these people interact with people that they perceive as outsiders, don't really trust, and what inside everyday life reveals to people once they are included in the inner circle. That wasn't always easy for me because of my gender. I was seen as an unmarried young girl, and it, on one hand, made it easier for me to make connection with other girls, other women, but at the same time, it also introduced a kind of distance for me to make friendships or a trusting relationship with Muslim men. And a number of religious spaces that I encountered, such as a local prayer space within the Bangladeshi ethnic community, I found didn't have accommodations to include women. So those spaces were off limits for me just because of my positionality. Another thing that I observed was, a lot of people told me, because they thought that this is what I wanted to hear, how religious they were, that they prayed five times a day and they fasted. Well, after I spent a lot of time with them, almost the whole day, I saw that the prayer times came and went, and they didn't really go off and went off to do their prayers. So it was a lot of fun embedding myself in these people's lives, but there were moments when I felt I was an insider, and there were moments when I clearly felt like an outsider. But I think something that adds to the strength of ethnography is that all these different kinds of moments were great access to data.
And I think, you know, one of the things I appreciate about the book is the way that you've woven in the narratives, right? I think it feels so seamless when you're reading it, and you get the sense of the your interlocutors as much as your voice, as much as kind of the theoretical work that you're trying to do. And so the way that it's all brought in together, I thought was really well done. So I'm really appreciative of that. I wonder if we could talk about then some of the experiences you had in terms of what the students were saying in their conceptions of elsewhere, how they themselves were locating their kind of identities that were really like tethered to like sometimes ethnicity, sometimes nationality, religion often, but like the religion sometimes like, you know, being Muslim superseded ethnicity at times, superseded nationality at times. So like this is like the really messy part and enjoyable part of some of the data that you are presenting us. And I wonder if you could go to the discussion of elsewhere and the ways in which some of your interlocutors responded to, let's say, the Syrian refugee crisis versus the Rohingya crisis and in South Asia itself, right? And so like you're talking to South Asians, and they're having these very different responses to these two, you know, global events. And I think that is one of the main points you're trying to make about elsewhere. So I wonder if you could unpack that for us.
Thank you.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
One of the fun things that I found after doing my field work is, as a sociologist, as a researcher, I saw how elsewhere was a meaningful point in my participants' lives, as well as how others perceived my participants at different moments of time. But my participants were not aware of this connection or actively cognizant about this connection. They didn't use elsewhere, the word elsewhere, to describe their lives or their location in their worldview. But that doesn't mean that it is not relevant or meaningful for their lives. For example, I use two concurrent refugee crises to make this point. There was the Syrian refugee crisis that grabbed the world's attention very heartbreakingly when the picture of Aylan was splashed across newspapers all over the world. But at the same time, there was another refugee crisis ongoing, and that was the Rohingya refugee crisis. And the second crisis, the Rohingya refugee crisis, was actually in the immigrants' homelands. It involved directly Bangladesh, and other South Asian and Southeast Asian countries. When I was doing field work, I saw, so let me backtrack a little bit. I strategically decided not to observe participants, interview participants in activist organizations, political organizations, because I felt that I would then be sampling on the dependent variable. In other words, interviewing people I know are already exposed to that kind of thinking and exposed to that kind of news of global events. So I intentionally wanted to study people in spaces that were apolitical, you know, trying to look at everyday conceptions of these events and places. And what I saw is that even in family spaces, apolitical hangouts like dorm rooms or just cultural associations or, you know, hangouts among friends in some people's houses, people brought up the Syrian refugee crisis. They were donating money. They were following the world news. They were looking at social media trends. They felt emotionally invested. They were talking about collecting money in their mosques to make donations collectively, but they never brought up the Rohingya refugee crisis, even though it was happening, it was unfolding in Bangladesh. And when I asked my interviewees about what their thoughts were about the Rohingya refugee crisis, they had, most of my participants had no idea that this is happening. The one or two that made some, you know, passing comments had to do mostly with their reading of the corruption of Bangladeshi politicians and ineffective policies, but not really that I didn't really see that emotional attachment, even though these were also Muslims, these were also their compatriots. Ethnicity wise. So it was surprising. It was a surprising finding that even that you would assume that as immigrants, their primary ties, even in the second generation, that they would be more involved with their ancestral homeland. But it wasn't the case at all. They were more invested in a country that they have never visited, that they have very vague ideas about in every sense of the word and elsewhere. And I argue that this is because as South Asian nationals in the United States, they were in a geopolitical, sociopolitical hierarchy where it mattered more what happened in faraway Middle East than what was happening back in the homeland. So their nationality matters here because they would much rather focus on what happened far away than look back in their homeland where, you know, you dig a little deeper and then you unearth a number of inter-ethnic South Asian conflicts that between Bangladesh and Pakistan, Pakistan and India. It's much easier to focus on what's going on far away with no direct impact on your ethnic identity, but at the same time, that what is going on in that faraway place is more consequential about how others, your peers, non-immigrant peers, non-Muslim peers around you are perceiving you.
And this came up again as you were talking about during, you know, the presidential election in 2016 and Bernie Sanders' candidacy and the role that the Palestinian plight played again, right, for your interlocutors who found more of an affinity to that cause, again, versus what was happening in the South Asian context or even the South Asian diasporic context of Indians supporting Trump, right? Like there was just kind of this fascinating move that the Middle East, quote unquote, however we define the Middle East and kind of the global Muslim identity seemed to be more superseding of than the ethnic, like localized ethnic identity.
Yes. So when especially the younger South Asian Muslim participants, really supported Bernie Sanders, expressed their support on social media very explicitly. And their support stemmed from his foreign policy views towards Palestine. What that indicated to my participants was that if he is sympathetic about Muslims elsewhere, he will also be sympathetic to Muslim issues here in the United States, where they live. At the same time, they used an ummatic logic towards feeling invested in the Palestinian issue. For example, they wanted the world's recognition that the Palestinians were oppressed or marginalized. They use the same ummatic logic about divesting from Turkey because it did not recognize the Armenian genocide, because they felt that, well, as Muslims, if we are to resist injustice here, we also have to resist injustice there, regardless of, whether it is considered a quote-unquote Muslim issue or not. But when I asked them that, you know, that's great that you think that you should divest from Turkey because of its denial of the Armenian genocide, well, Pakistan, which is your homeland, also denies and has not yet officially apologized for the genocide that it conducted in Bangladesh, just over three decades ago. And some of them were not even aware that this genocide had happened. They had very vague ideas about that part of their history. And I think what that shows is there is a limit to that global religious identity or that global Muslim space. Because Pakistan was not just their homeland, it also involved Muslims, but they were not cognizant about that connection. So this is a space where I think that, you know, ethnicity, borders, nationality matters, because it's much more relevant to them to respond to faraway foreign places rather than respond to conflicts that are happening in their backyard, because then that would make their lives more difficult in the diaspora. That would mean that they have to engage in direct conflict or direct arguments and debates with their friends.
And which is so fascinating, because then the flip side to this is what you highlight, that in instances of hostland events, like Islamophobic, and anti-Muslim violence, then the South Asian kind of, your participants are also stuck in that moment as well, right? And I think this is also compounded by the fact that there's events in the elsewhere context. If something's happening in Europe, which they have physically no ties to, but beyond the fact that, the Charlie Hebdo event happened or an ISIS attack happened in Germany or in Paris, then their identities in the context of America is also impacted because they are Muslims, right? And so this is another dimension of the elsewhere that you bring in, which I thought was so important.
Yes, exactly. So this is not a two-way street. On one hand, immigrants self-identify with different elsewheres. On the other hand, they are identified by others in relation to elsewhere. And despite the salience of the Middle East and how these immigrants self-identify, I argue that is actually the Muslim-related instances in Europe that determine how these immigrants are perceived by others in America. So, for example, when I traced the response from my participants and the hostland to six ISIS attacks, two in the United States, two in the Middle East, and two in Europe. And what I found is when attacks, ISIS attacks in Brussels and Paris happened, my participants did not feel connected to the Muslims there. They were very aggrieved that they now have to be vocal about their religious identities, that they do not identify with violence, they do not identify with those Islamists who conducted these attacks. At the same time, they did not feel a sense of ummatic connection with the Muslims in those places, or a sense of diasporic affinity that, there are my, that is the home of my Bangladeshi compatriots. No, they wanted to distance themselves from that entirely. But they were pulled, they were associated with that elsewhere place, in this case France, by how other people associated them with the perpetrators of those attacks. They became connected to Paris, even though they didn't want to. So I show that example, I use that example to show that even as immigrants themselves connect them to certain elsewheres, they are also connected by others to different elsewheres. Even though they may not feel connected to those places in the first place.
And this is so fascinating. I mean, and a lot of this you also were mapping on social media, which I thought was so interesting, like on Facebook and Twitter. So what role do you think then social media has? Like, we're talking about diasporic identities, now we're unsettling kind of the homeland, hostland, but now there's also like the cyberland that's adding to kind of this globalized, identity. So what role do you think social media and the internet has in formulating these complex identities?
I think that the social media is a very important component in how global political events get filtered down to everyday life, not just for the immigrants, but also for those around immigrants. Social media exposes people to events that are far away. In one sense, it is an equalizer. Anyone can log on to Facebook and post what is happening, in their neighborhood, in their country. So I think that social media exposes people to a number of potential elsewheres. It also breaks down these complex global issues to very digestible pieces, a few phrases, a few words. It also helps to trend certain issues over others. That makes certain things relevant to people just based on the context that they are in. So I think that social media helps to facilitate the interconnectedness of our globalized world in this time and era. But I also wonder if social media makes certain things more shocking than they are. I don't think, I haven't done this study, but I don't think that social media makes certain events more shocking than others, because there have been attacks by Muslims against other Muslims. Those things have not trended on social media. I haven't seen, Muslims themselves using that space to highlight those issues. But I have seen a number of events during my field work that trended, that was seen as more relevant to my participants because of social media, just so they know what is happening. And if someone asks them about their perspective as Muslims, they know how to respond.
And yeah, this is obvious when, the Beirut event attacks, which was just before I think the Paris attacks, didn't get as much attention, or what happened in Istanbul at the airport also didn't get. So there was kind of a hierarchy of which events got traction on social media and news media generally. and how your participants were also responding to that. But you're also highlighting that there's a generational factor, right? Because you also interviewed some folks who were the immigrants and then the ones who are the 1.5 or the second generation. And you found that there were differences in terms of how they related to the elsewhere, right? Like maybe the parents had more of a sense or connection or affinity to South Asia versus the students or the children maybe did not, had more of a sense of like the Middle East as the elsewhere.
Yes. So one thing I would say about social media, because I think it is related to your question about the intergenerational differences, is that social media is a great space to look at how immigrants present themselves as quote unquote good Muslims, citizens of the United States, who are also members of the global community of Muslims or Ummah. Because Facebook, for instance, you can actually craft your narrative, you know, post a status, and even control who gets to see those posts. So this is a space that I saw my participants use to try to carve their own narrative, control how they want to be perceived. And I have seen that effort to present themselves as individually good Muslims collectively show that they are Muslims and Americans. And social media is definitely a space that is used most by the younger generation, 1.5 and second generation South Asian Muslim Americans. Sometimes to distance themselves from elsewhere events and sometimes to associate themselves to elsewhere contexts. I did not find this as much with the first generation participants, but that does not mean that these immigrants did not feel or associate themselves to the elsewhere effect, because they are also living in the United States. They are also part of this geopolitical global context that makes certain places relevant to their lives than certain other places that are left as just anywheres. So the first generation was quite reluctant or hesitant, I would say, to be on the record talking about their religious worldviews, their political opinions, and they were more hesitant to associate their organizations, for instance, to Middle East issues. For example, a Bangladeshi charity organization that I visited were very reluctant to sponsor any issue that had any connection to the Middle East, because they felt that having that connection would make them more vulnerable to the punitive surveillance measures of the state. But that does not mean that they did not feel a connection to the Middle East. Their worldview as Muslims was very much colored by elsewhere Middle Eastern places such as Saudi Arabia, Palestine, Iran. But for the second generation, they were actually very vocal about what they felt that they should speak about as Muslims. They did not have that perception that speaking out as Muslims would make them any less American, that it would expose them to punitive measures. So both the first generation and the children of immigrants, they were part of this global community of Muslims. They identified with this global community of Muslims. They were associated by others to Muslims elsewhere, but how they responded was different. The first generation was more hesitant to speak about these things, whereas the second generation and the 1.5 generation felt that It is by speaking out as Muslims that you become more Muslim American.
Justine, I wonder if you could take a step back and reflect on the broader project and, you know, what would you want readers to take away as some of the main interventions, maybe either for migration studies, diaspora studies, or folks like myself who think about Islam and, you know, Islam in America?
I think that my book extends the scholarship of international migration by showing, by presenting a new analytical model for studying immigrant identity formation. I call it the multi-centered relational framework, which can encompass global politics in not just the immigrant sending and receiving countries, but also in those places beyond, the places that I conceptualize as elsewhere. I show in my book that places beyond the homeland and hostland are meaningful for not just immigrants, but also others. Immigrants self-identify with elsewhere, beyond the homeland and hostland, and others also perceive immigrants in light of these elsewhere contexts. I think that especially now in when we are seeing the COVID-19 pandemic unfold, there is more evidence now why immigrants' experiences should be located in connection to context, not just here and there, but also elsewhere. What happens in a faraway foreign land does not stop at its borders, but can produce domino effects that affect our daily lives here. So my book presents a systematic analysis of how immigrants are located in connection to global politics in the homeland, hostland, and elsewhere. And it is only by looking at immigrants in such a globalized way that I think we can get a more accurate picture.
And I want to pick up on one final point that you mentioned in your conclusion, and this is really about like the applicability or generalizability of the conceptual framework that you've productively offered us to other case studies. And one of the, or two of the examples that you mentioned in your conclusion that you were kind of thinking about was like, can this framework apply to non-immigrant groups? Like, can this, you know, framework apply to African-American Muslims in African-American Muslims or to Latinos in America? And I know you were just beginning to think through that. And I wonder if you could think through that with us here too, of like what you think the applicability of this framework that you've given us is to other cases. Or do you think, you know, the whole time reading it, I was really thinking like, is this something that's really specific to, you know, the Muslim diaspora context, right? And so I wonder what your thoughts on that is.
Of course. So you mentioned two examples that I actually reflect on in the concluding chapter of the book. I use the example of Latinos to show that this is a racialized group that is non-Muslim. So does the elsewhere framework explain their experiences better in a globalized way, even though this population is not Muslim? And I show that I show some examples that suggest to us that it can show how elsewhere affects this immigrant group. For example, even though they are non-Muslim, they are perceived as Muslim because of 9/11 and the subsequent changes in the immigration policies. It is not Muslims who were affected the most. It was Latinos. They're the ones who are having their surveillance measures encroach on their private lives into their homes. I'm not saying that this is not happening for Muslims, but they're the ones who are seen as people we have to get, you know, keep out by building a wall. So they are not from the Middle East. They are not from South Asia. They are not Muslims. But nonetheless, what happened in the Middle East has affected, for example, immigrants coming from Mexico to the United States. Does the elsewhere framework help explain things that are happening outside of the United States? Well, let's look at South Asian Muslims in Canada. When 9/11 happened, when the ISIS attacks happened in San Bernardino, in France, South Asian Muslims in Canada also felt that backlash, even though those attacks didn't happen in South Asia or Canada. It happened either in the United States or far away in Europe. But nonetheless, we know of ethnographic reports that show that, you know, South Asian Muslims in there were afraid, feared a backlash in their local neighborhoods. So I understand that this is still a North American context. I have to do more research, you know, as I go forward with this framework about how it travels to the global South, whether, for instance, Muslims in the Middle East are perceive Muslims in South Asia or contexts that are happening in South Asia as and elsewhere. So I have to look at those examples, but so far, using the examples of Latinos and South Asian Muslim Canadians, I argue that there is something there that we need to observe more. And one project that I have in mind is to look at whether elsewhere is meaningful for African American Muslims. That's because we know from the ethnographic literature on the Muslim community that there are tensions and conflicts between immigrant Muslims and Black Muslims. Whereas foreign policy issues and, you know, Muslims in faraway Middle East is very meaningful to immigrant Muslims, for Black Muslims, it's their race, how they are seen as not just stigmatized religious group, but also as racialized, very racialized others as Blacks. So the way that they have navigated their religious identity is more rooted in the racial dynamics in the United States than immigrant Muslims. So that is something that I want to explore deeper going forward.
Yeah, just in the concluding chapter alone, there were so many things to think about, and you've given us a lot to think about. So congratulations again on a fantastic book. As the last question, you've kind of alluded to already, but hopefully you're taking a break because the book just published and you're also teaching online, as a lot of us are. But are there things that are kind of stewing in terms of projects that we can expect from you down the road or in the future?
The next project that I have two projects that I'm very excited about. One is to do a retrospective analysis of an immigrant group that we have thus far understood as being located within the dyadic homeland Hosan paradigm. So I'm thinking of Irish Americans, but then using an elsewhere or a multi-centered relational framework to see what new insights using that lens actually reveals. So doing a retrospective project. The other project that I'm interested in is looking at the effects of geopolitics on immigrant identity making in intimate spaces, by which I mean how do immigrants make friendships, romantic relationships, relationships at work? How do these interactions locate immigrants in a global space, and conversely, how do global politics really affect who Muslims marry, who they go out with, how they negotiate within their own community, or how they navigate the interactions with their work colleagues, with their friends? So using that same framework, but in a more intimate setting.
Oh, that sounds so exciting. Well, I look forward to your projects, and I'm so grateful that we had the opportunity to talk about your wonderful book, Here, There, and Elsewhere, The Making of Immigrant Identities in a Globalized World. Thank you so much, Tissy.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Professor Tasin Shams about her new book, Here, There, and Elsewhere, The Making of an Immigrant Identities in a Globalized World by Stanford University Press, published in 2020. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope to have you join us again next time. Take care and stay well.